CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 30 with Bill Trattler. Dr. Trattler is a corneal cataract refractive surgeon in Miami, Florida. You've also seen him in many meetings on the podium where he has a knack for really teaching in a very simplified manner. And he does this with case studies. We'll talk all about that in the podcast. We also talk about various corneal diseases and what we do now to approach them. How do we think differently about them, whether it's keratoconus or Fuchs dystrophy or some other irregularities in the cornea? How do you maximize your topography settings to be able to pick up these disease processes? What's his protocol for cataract surgery? So much more great information. You'll learn about his ophthalmology family and his passion for fun sports like skiing. Check it out. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today with one of my all-time favorite teachers, Bill Trattler. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Uday. It's so amazing to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you've got an amazing knack for teaching. In fact, I love your lecture style because your lecture style is big on case presentations. And what people may not realize in the audience is your panelists are always blindsided by your questions. You never prepare them ahead of time. You put them on the spot.
Well, it's much more fun. Like we like to be spontaneous because, like, when you're in clinic and seeing a patient, no one told you what to expect. You have to be ready for anything. So, same thing here on the podium. It's a lot of fun to kind of have fun, interesting cases.
Yeah, so I love that style too. I think it kind of makes you think because the case-based scenarios. In fact, that's how you've changed your the ACOS meeting in Deer Valley. You've made it so beautiful where it's like, here's an interesting case, and now let's discuss.
Yeah. Yes, Stephen Della is actually Stephen Della's concept, so he gets the credit for that change, because it's a big change. We got rid of all didactic lectures. It's only cases at ACOS Deer Valley, and it's turned out to be just amazing. It's just such a fun meeting to have everyone involved.
Yeah, for sure. So tell me about the meetings that you're involved in. You're involved in a lot of these meetings and certainly the planning of them. And how do you come up with the kind of the format of how you do the meetings?
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that there are so many excellent meetings. I find I really love the smaller meetings, you know, anywhere from 50 to 200 doctors or so, because I think you can learn so much in it. And I also like more when it's a one track, because like everyone's together, learning together, versus like three or four different people in three or four different rooms. I think it's much better. So those are the meetings I look for and like to get involved in. And so I guess like obviously ACOS is a big part of my involvement. I'm on the, you know, I'm a co-program organizer with Stephen Dell. And that's a great one because we get a lot of the younger doctors get involved in that meeting. And it's just and also industry, so it's just a great interactive meeting. But then we have obviously OS in New York, which I know I'll see you at every year. Hawaii and I, which I see you at every year. It's just a lot of great meetings. I feel very fortunate to be involved in.
Yeah, for sure. I think I feel the same way, and I like the way it's kind of how our attention spans have gotten shorter and shorter. Like no one wants to watch a 20-minute surgery, so I've got to edit all my cataract videos to like 5 minutes or less. In fact, even one step beyond, now people want to watch videos on Instagram. Just clips, short clips. So similarly, like at the meetings, I like that the case presentations kind of move right to the punchline.
Exactly. So I think that's the key. It's like if someone's given 10 minute slot for a lecture, you don't want the speaker speaking for 10 minutes and 35 seconds. What you want them to do is give about a 6 minute talk with 4 minutes of discussion with the panelists so you could all learn, because everyone has great concepts in their presentation, but then everyone has questions. If you don't leave time for questions and discussion, then it's not quite as interesting or impactful. So that's why we try to tell our speakers, all the things I'm involved in, it's shorter lecture time, just be very focused on what you want to teach the audience, and then allow time for discussion and questions.
Yeah, and I also like the way you do it too, is you'll show the case and then you'll say, okay, just get the audience thinking. Do you think it's choice A or B or C? Like, what's your next move?
Right. Well, I mean, again, I was at ACOS and you did a great job with that, with all your cataract videos, like which way should we go? But again, that's the key thing is that there's not always one right answer either, right? So let's give some good ideas and say, okay, we could do this approach or that approach, and everyone can share what works best in their practice.
In fact, yeah, some of the most fun cases and the most instructive are the cases where there is no absolute answer.
Yes,
and there's absolutely many ways to approach it, right?
Absolutely, and guess what? If we come back 10 years later, or even 5 years later, we may have a completely different answer because new technologies and new ways of approaching those patients will be available.
Yeah, I mean, so true. Things have kept evolving, obviously, in our field, and we don't operate the way we did 10 years ago. I also like a lot of you had some really amazing suggestions about even how to set up the color gradient on your topographer so you don't miss things.
Yes. I mean, that was work that some people have been involved in. But, you know, what I learned, you know, because I get emails almost every day from people asking to interpret topography and what they think about the topography. And you want to have a scale that you can see the details. If it's all green, because the scale is so large that you can't see the differences, then you're going to miss that there's inferior steepening or irregularity. So you want to have it a very, you know, again, every topographer is a little different, but usually it's a 0.25 or 0.5 diopter scale. Now let you see the details and identify, is this a plusive pattern? Is there inferior steepening or some other irregularity? And I think, and obviously, most people just think that the topography as is good. You buy it and you put it, set up and start scanning patients, but you can really customize it to get better information.
Yeah, in fact, I learned from you also that, like, all those things, instead of thinking of distinct identities of, like, this is keratoconus, this is pellucid, this is surgical ectasia, it's kind of like a spectrum. It's not so cut and dry.
Right. So I think you remember, it was, not this summer, but the summer before, I showed identical, you know, from two different patients, pentacams of patients that had what looked like keratoconus. But one had a history of LASIK and one did not. But there's no way you could tell the difference. And I have many examples of that. And because I was just looking for similar patterns. And the answer is that they are similar conditions. You don't need to say this is post-LASIK ectasia and this is keratoconus. They really are the same condition. They're just some patients have a history of LASIK and then develop keratoconus. We do call it post-LASIK ectasia, but the treatment's exactly the same.
Well, speaking of the treatment, I mean, you've done a lot of work there with cross-linking. Tell us about that. And what do you think is the right way of doing cross-linking today, 2023?
Well, we're very lucky that we have a lot of investment of industry putting money in to try to further advance cross-linking, because in the U.S., just because there's internationally great ways of doing cross-linking, we don't always get access to that here in the U.S. So companies have to help sponsor research and get those technologies and make it available to us. So right now we have one system that works very nicely, the Glaukos system, which is an EpiOff system. Both Glaukos and a company called EpiOn are both working on epithelial on cross-linking, which has been my focus for the last 14 years, which is drops only. So basically, instead of removing the epithelium, there's a solution that where the riboflavin that gets into the cornea, so you don't have to remove the epithelium, and then you can just do your UV light and patients get excellent results. And so that's the future. I'm not sure, Glaukos is likely going to be approved first, and then EpiOn hopefully will be approved shortly thereafter. And then our patients will not have to have epithelial removal in the future. But right now, that's what's available is epithelial off cross-linking, and that's, you know, the widely available treatment for patients with keratoconus.
Yeah, interesting here. So your practice must be pretty heavy on treating these keratoconic patients.
Yes, I feel very lucky, you know, since I guess I was the right place at the right time. I got involved early with the Glaukos clinical trial in 2008 and then with a different company called CXL USA in 2009. So I got very involved in cross-linking early, and we've had a chance to treat a lot of patients and learn a lot so we could really help our patients and realize that even patients that are very thin can be treated, patients that are very steep can be treated, even patients that are older. I just had a patient who was 79 years old, cataracts, and keratoconus, and we said, let's do the cross-linking first. So one eye wasn't as bad as the other. The eye that was not as bad but had obvious inferior steepening, that eye looks almost normal now a year after the crossing. So now he's 80, and it looks so much better. The left eye that was more advanced keratoconus is way flatter after the first year, and we expect each year to get a little better. We decided to wait one more year to let the cornea continue to reshape, and then we'll talk about cataract surgery when he's 81. But he'll have a much better...
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. So...
And obviously better lens calcs, because now you've got a more stable cornea. You can get a little bit more accurate keratometry. Tell me about that. What are your pearls for doing lens calcs in KC patients, in keratoconics?
Well, that's always a challenge. So, again, in this patient, it worked out really well. Just the point is that with cross-linking, a lot of patients will get reshaping of the cornea, improvement in the corneal shape, which doesn't happen to everybody, but a lot of patients get that. And this patient was very fortunate to have a nice improvement. For our patients that come in that have keratoconus and cataracts, and the cataracts are already visually significant to a point where, listen, they need surgery, I don't do cross-linking first. We need to really get these patients functional again. So we do cataract surgery at that time. And figuring out the calculation is always a challenge. I think the formulas often try to suggest that we should go very very low numbers. You often will see a minus number, in fact, like putting a minus 10 intraocular lens. It turns out that there's some misreading there. So the best thing to do is to use a formula that I love. There's a Kane keratoconus formula and obviously the Barrett keratoconus formula. Those are the two formulas that I use. And then it kind of fixes that the error from some of the other formulas so you don't get don't end up way off target.
But if you look at like their topography, do you want to kind of say, okay, where's the flatter part of the cornea? If that's kind of more central, kind of hedge your numbers that direction?
It can be tough. I mean, it sounds really like a cool idea. And then Dr. Holliday has a little formula in the Pentacam that could try to put in the Ks that he's developed that are the mean Ks in certain area within the pupil, for example. But it still can be a little tough because you don't know, is a patient looking right through the middle or slightly down, like where they're looking. So I think the more advanced cases are always difficult. At the end of the day, if they're wearing a scleral lens beforehand, that makes it easy because you just try to end up a little bit on the myopic side and they're going to go back to the scleral lens afterwards. And then if you do have a big miss, you can always do a piggyback lens, which is thankfully not common, but there are options to help out for those patients.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, now one thing that I found is interesting and I was a little surprised about, I've been starting to do ICLs for patients with keratoconus. I don't know if you have any experience with eyes. You think that, my gosh, this patient does not correct to 20/20. If I put an ICL, I'll definitely reduce their myopia, but they're still not going to see that well. But oh my gosh, the patients, and it's a limited number, but they're so happy because you're taking patients that are minus 10, putting the ICL in, and they're getting improvement in their best corrected visual acuity because I guess the way the ICL works is at a really nice optical spot in the eye. So patients are seeing really well. And I've been pretty surprised at how happy these patients are because they're no longer super nearsighted. Like my one patient said, oh my God, I can see the world. I actually can wake up and I can look and see things. Now, he still couldn't, my most recent patient is going to get fitted with a scleral lens still for, driving and stuff like that. But at least I got rid of all this myopia and he's like much more functional. And then I have another patient who I treated who's doesn't need anything else. That was it. The ICLs work beautifully, and his vision, even though it's best corrected about 20/40 pre-op, he's at about 20/25 uncorrected one eye, and I think 20/40 in the other, which is surprising. I didn't expect that type of result.
Wow. So going back to the patient who had the KC and you put the ICL in and they go with a scleral lens, and obviously you're not putting in a toric ICL because then you'll unmask it with the scleral lens then.
Exactly. You're just trying to knock out all that myopia. It's for patients that are very, very nearsighted. Some patients have like a minus 12, minus 14 level myopia. They may have 5 diopters of astigmatism. Don't worry about the astigmatism. You're just trying to knock out a lot of that myopia so that they can actually open their eyes, actually see things in focus. Or not even focus, I should say, but at least things aren't, so difficult to see. Because normally they have to look like this to see anything. There's a podcast. They have to hold things, a millimeter from their face to see what they're looking at. Now, the world has opened up to them. They can see a lot better. And surprisingly, they do get some improvement in best corrected visual acuity, which I wasn't expecting.
Now, do you aim for the spherical equivalent of zero or plano, or are you aiming for a little bit of residual myopia? What are you aiming for?
Well, I'm aiming for, it's all based on refraction. So, I'm aiming for plano on these patients at this point. These are patients who are kind of in their 30s, like mid to late 30s. So, plano is a good spot to target for them. They've also had previous cross-linking, just to mention that. But I know that they're not going to get worse. I feel confident they won't get worse as far as their keratoconus goes. If I had a patient that was younger, I guess in their 20s, you might even target a little bit of hyperopia because they can actually accommodate through the hyperopia and their pupil will be a little smaller, so that might help a little bit too. But I haven't treated a 20-year-old with ICLs who also has keratoconus.
What about now for a cataract patient, would you consider doing the small aperture lens?
So the small aperture lens is super exciting. The one thing I've learned since I've used it a handful of times, I should say two times in particular, is that it doesn't get rid of a lot of astigmatism. The patients don't like it if they have a lot of astigmatism that's irregular within the visual axis. So it's a very nice technology, but I was kind of aggressive. I had two patients that were waiting for 2 years to have it done because they had really bad irregularities in their corneas. And what I learned from that is that they're getting glare and halo at nighttime because they still, even though it's a small aperture and their astigmatism is reduced, they still have all this irregularity within that aperture, and they're still seeing not that great at nighttime. Their daytime seems to be reasonably good, but nighttime they feel very uncomfortable. So I've learned that we need to be a little bit more focused and kind of find those patients that are more mild irregularity, not severe irregularity.
Or the irregularity is kind of outside that aperture zone.
That would be helpful too. Yes, I don't have all the details, but I think we're all going to learn. And you know, I'm working with the patients. For one patient, he also, besides having keratoconus, has EBMD. So I'm going to work on just getting rid of that EBMD now to see if that helps at all, and then maybe do another little procedure to try to reduce the astigmatism next. But we'll see.
Well, like speaking of EBMD, I learned that from you also about the importance of the ocular surface in your lens couch. You show a topography. And it's okay, here, we'll do the lens calcs, and then you just buff up the ocular surface. A month later, the calcs are totally different.
Yes, oh my God, isn't it amazing? You know, I think we learned so much from the fact that now we get picture images of the eye. So I think most people now get topography. And if you see irregularity, it's either caused by dry eye, MGD, or EBMD, or maybe Salzman's. But usually, if it's EBMD or Salzman's, you should be able to see it on slit lamp exam. And then if you fix those situations, they're going to end up with a much better result. And I always love I'm a before and after fan. I love doing showing a pre-op, whatever we do to make it better, and then show the post-op. And right. It can be surprising. Some of these topographies can look like keratoconus, but it's actually caused by EBMD or dry eye, and then you fix them and they have a more normal shape.
Yeah, and it's important to remember, right? A one diopter change in corneal power is about one diopter change in the IOL power with the lens calcs.
Absolutely, yes. It goes one way, as you mentioned. And so if we can just adjust that or fix that, take our time. There's no urgency to get to cataract surgery itself. Fix the cornea so they're going to have a better reading, so a more accurate IOL planning, will end up in a better spot.
Awesome. Tell me about right now, in your clinic, what's your kind of state-of-the-art cataract protocol? What are you doing? What do you measure pre-op? To examine the patients, what biometry are you doing, or tomography? What do you like intraop, and what are kind of your fastball lenses that you like these days, premium and also monofocal?
Oh, perfect. I mean, it's a lot of fun. I think we're so lucky, and I think if you interview me in 6 months, I might change somewhat. So to some degree, because we're always like looking for that next generation technology. Well, first of all, I put a lot of my patients who come in for the initial consultation on hypochlorous acid spray and topical steroids, because they often have MGD and dry eye. And so I find that's a very fast way of improving the ocular surface. The steroid drops help with reducing inflammation, and they often help get rid of some of that punctate epithelial erosions on the cornea. And the hypochlorous acid spray works well because you're reducing the bacterial load in the eyelashes, you're getting better meibomian gland secretion. So that's the combo I've been using for a while now. Obviously, we have some new
steroid. Are you using prednisolone, loteprednol? What are you doing?
Well, so I love loteprednol, but we have insurance issues in South Florida sometimes where, you know, the Medicare patients can't get coverage with certain brand name loteprednol. So I end up using just 3 weeks of prednisolone acetate. It's usually generic, and it works great.
Are you using it four times a day?
Just using it twice a day with the steroid, and twice a day with the hypochlorous acid spray. I have the patient spray this their fingertip, and the fingertip is immediately clean. They just paint it directly on their eyelashes, and again, it kills the bacteria. And I think about this also. We're trying to reduce the bacteria in and around the eye, so hopefully that also reduces the risk for infection. It's not been studied, but I have the patients continue the hypochlorous acid spray through surgery as well. So that's kind of how I tune up the ocular surface for most patients. Now, sometimes patients need more. Sometimes we have to, you know, do additional weeks of treatments, you know, but or add other therapies. But that's what I've been doing, in the past, you know. And so,
what percent of your patients pre-op need this steroid plus hypochloric acid? Is it a small percent, or are you doing it for everyone?
It's about 60%. Some people are, you know, that you look and you get beautiful readings, you know, everything's lining up nicely. And what I do is, as you mentioned, the critical part for me is I take three measurements of astigmatism. So I do have the IOL Master 700, we have a Cassini, and we have a Pentacam, and patients get all three. And you should see reasonably good alignment for both the magnitude of astigmatism and the axis on all three devices if there's not much ocular surface disease or MG, you know, evaporative dry eye. And so if they all line up, let's say someone has two diopters of astigmatism on all three at a similar axis, never going to be exactly precise, then you feel pretty good. Okay, this patient's ready to go. We can figure out what treatment plans to offer. But if you see differences in either the magnitude of astigmatism or the axis between the three devices, then you know they need tuning up. They need, you know, again, I explain how I'm typically treating patients, but we can always add more. There's so many other devices or technology we can use as well.
Cool. So yeah. Your pre-op is those three devices to measure, And yes. then are you also doing OCT macula, osteopic nerve?
What of course. So I get the macula, OCT of the macula as well. I think it's a critical test because we want to, one, you know, it can see things I can't see. Number two is I want to have a baseline because when the patient comes back in a month and they're something they're not seeing well, we find something, I want to make sure that we can correlate to what it looks like beforehand. So even though the AlloMaster 700 provides a little tiny amount of the macula in that one scan, I don't find that helpful enough. So I do get a true OCT. We have the Zeiss technology for the OCT. Of the macula. So that's what the patient are getting preoperatively. And then postoperatively, they don't necessarily need certain scans. If they end up not seeing well, we'll, of course, get an OCT of the macula. We'll repeat the pentacam to make sure there's not something, there's been no shift or change in the pentacam if there's any issues postoperatively. But those are the devices I'm working with.
Cool. And I'll tell you about your surgical technique. Are you a big femto guy? Do you like intraop aberrometry? What's your typical cataract surgery these days?
Well, we feel very fortunate that we have the LENSAR system at our center. We have 5 ORs that can do cataract surgery, and we have 2 LENSAR systems in our center. We're about to switch from the original LENSAR to the Ally system, so we'll end up with 3 lasers in our center. And then what's nice about that is that the LENSAR system allows us to take the Cassini preoperatively and put that into the laser, and then it puts these little marks on the capsule as well as marks on the cornea, and then I don't even have to do much. Like, basically, I do the cataract surgery and the marks are there, so my toric lenses are just as quick and fast as a monofocal lens or a lens without astigmatism. Makes it really easy. Of course, I'm sure you know also that my father works with me, so my dad's actually the doing the lasers for me. So my dad actually goes...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so my father, who's he just tastes his 83rd birthday, he'll go and sees the patients in the preoperative area, talks to them, like, makes them nice and relaxed. Every patient always comments how nice it is that he's, like, got them relaxed. So he tells good stories. He then does the laser, and then I'm jumping between 2 rooms, and then I'll do the second part, the intraoperative part of the surgery. But it tees it up, and again, I do a lot of patients have astigmatism. And I think one thing that people don't realize is that even if you have 0.7 diopters of astigmatism, there are lenses that can be used that can correct that degree of astigmatism. So when the calculations suggest that there's 0.7 will be residual, I'll use a B&L toric lens that corrects about 0.85 of astigmatism, and patients end up doing really, really well in that scenario. So even 0.7, I'll treat with a lens. I am a fan, as you're probably realizing, I'm not a fan of AKs. I'm a fan of using a toric lens for treating astigmatism.
Oh, I think you're right. Certainly at a diopter and above, I think a toric lens is so much more accurate than doing any kind of astigmatic keratotomy, et cetera. For sure. Intraop, what's your technique? We should probably feature a video of you on Cataract Coach of how you do a routine case. So you're using the laser then to fragment the lens as well?
Yes, so the laser does the capsulotomy and fragments the lens where I'm not using it for incisions. And then my technique is pretty straightforward. I'm happy to send you a video. And then basically obviously I do non-laser for cases too, but my technique for disassembling the lens is I do a double wide groove. So I'm taking, it's like 2 phaco tips in width, and I make a central crack. Then I use my side belt chopper, go underneath the one side that's easy to get, pull that into the middle and just crack it in half, and then switch to setting 2, vacuum out the pieces from there, and then it's pretty straightforward. So it's a pretty efficient, safe technique for my patients. So that's how I disassemble lens.
And then what are you doing for post-op medications? Are you doing intracameral stuff? You're doing drops? What do you do?
Yes. Yeah, So I am a believer in using intracameral antibiotics to lower the risk or reduce the risk for endophthalmitis. So we're using intracameral moxifloxacin. We're using a 0.1 milligram per cc dosage. So I put 0.5 cc's inside the eye. That's been working out great for our center. It's really reduced.
Wait, 0.5 cc's or 0.05?
So when you're using 0.1 milligrams per cc, you can actually put in as much as you want.
You're the lower concentration, right?
Yeah. So Arshadov says, he uses a 0.15. So I'm using a little bit less than him. And at 0.15, he also said you can't, if you fill up the whole AC with that, you're fine. You won't have toxicity. We're using a little bit less. So I put 0.5 cc's. The reason is that I get the syringe with 0.5, and I'm starting to slowly put it into the eye at the end of the case, and I know stuff is coming out. And if I kind of think of my Vision Blue cases. So when we put Vision Blue in the eye and you start to rinse out the Vision Blue, it doesn't come out just by injecting, you know, 0.2, 0.3 cc's of BSS in the AC. It's still in there. So it takes a while to kind of flush out the system. So that's my concept of putting 0.5 cc's of Moxie, because I'm trying to, you know, I guess, flush out some of the aqueous or the fluid in the eye that doesn't have Moxie, and trying to, you know, get a good dosage in the eye, but it's again not a very high dosage. So that's the intraoperative antibiotic that we use, and then postoperatively we're using compounded drops. We use it starting 3 days beforehand. It's Pred Moxie Brom starting 3 days prior and 30 days after. I do love the. There's so many great FDA-approved medications for patients that are undergoing cataract surgery, but there's always insurance issues. So switching to the compounded has been life-changing for our staff and for the patients. It's much easier. There's no callbacks. It's been much easier. So we did that switch like 2 years ago, and it's worked out beautifully.
Yeah, I do something very similar. So we're also doing the intracameral Moxie as well, and then post-op, again, combination drop compounded of prednisolone, Moxifloxacin, Bromfenex. So we do the same thing.
Yes.
Oh. It's made life a lot easier.
Yeah, oh my God, so much. And then, like, if I see a patient, like, you know, that, let's say I see my patients the same day. So since our surgery center is on the second floor of our building and our office is in the fourth floor, patients come up and see me about an hour, 2 hours afterwards. We check the eye pressure. Like today was my surgery day, so I had one patient whose pressure was in the 50s. You know, it can just happen. So we work on that. I'm a big fan of not burping, but using drops, getting the pressure lower. So we identify that right afterwards. And then we're also looking, you know, making sure everything, like for our toric patients, that the lens is still like right where we left it, which is nice to see. And then also it helps us identify TAS, if a TAS were to occur early. And of course, I could have said it until 2 weeks ago that I've never seen a TAS, even though I've been doing this same day post-op for 10 years, but I had my first case 2 weeks ago. Thankfully, I saw her, and so right away we put her on steroid drops every hour. She came back the next day, and she was much, much better. But it was actually, she had all this fibrin in the AC like an hour and like 20 minutes after surgery. So it was kind of surprising, concerning, but we were able to treat it right away. And so I will use, besides using triple drops, I will add Pred in for that one case of TAS, but then also for patients that have a lot of corneal edema, you know, 2 hours after surgery, there's a lot of swelling. You know they're going to be a little swollen for a couple of days. Why not just hit them with a second drop? It does make it a little more difficult for that weekend, but, you know, they're going to use it as Pred for, you know, for, again, 3 days a week, depending on how they look the next week.
So you see the same day post-op, day zero post-op, and then when do you see them next?
So any day in the following, so we do surgery on Thursday, and then we tell them they can come back any day, Monday through Friday the following week, and they'll see my optometrist. I have two optometrists that do postoperative visits, and of course I'm there as well. So if there's anything interesting, concerning, I get called right over. My optometrists are wonderful. They're fantastic, but they are also extremely conservative. So anything that's out of the ordinary, they just call me over. Of course, my patients are thrilled to see me, and I'm thrilled to see them. So it's easy. It's literally just a few steps away. So it works out really well.
Awesome. And you're typically doing the eyes, let's say for a patient who has both eyes cataract, you're doing them a week or two apart?
Yeah, so for most of the time, it depends on their scheduling, but a week apart works great. It saves one trip for the patient because, when they come in for their second surgery, we'll then check their first eye at the same postoperative visit. So it makes it, they save one visit to the practice.
Oh, fantastic. They got a nice system there. I like it. Now, you have a big ophthalmology family. It's not just your dad. You've got a wife who's an ophthalmologist, too.
Yes. Yeah, oh, my God. She's amazing. Jennifer Lowe, and it's great because we operate the same day. So we're both at this facility together. So she's in one room, one or two rooms, and I'm in one or two rooms as well. So we actually get to end up, it looks like we typically share three rooms unless there's five rooms. So sometimes one of the other two doctors are not there, so then we each get two rooms. And so it's been great. She's a fantastic surgeon, and it's really fun working with her.
Well, it's interesting, too. You don't work in the same practice, though. You have separate practices.
Yes, and her practice is growing beautifully. She has two other surgeons in her practice, one other ophthalmologist as well, who's a medical ophthalmologist, and one medical optometrist. So she's got five doctors, including her, in their group. And her group's been doing great. And she's actually part of a big group called Eye Physicians of Florida that has 40 total doctors, and they have like 15 sites. It's kind of one of those practice without walls where they each have their own, I guess, center, but or cost center, but they all have one, this one big practice for working with insurances and one EMR system. So it just makes it a little bit easier to have a big framework and teamwork together.
Well, that sounds great. Now, all you got to do is convince one of your kids to do ophthalmology.
Yeah, so we're working on it. I'm trying to brainwash our 4-year-old, so we'll see if that happens.
Oh, that's amazing. No, sounds like a great setup here. And tell me about you going to meetings too now. So I've actually seen you pictures of you at some of her meetings, so you're just kind of like the plus one.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, she's getting invited to way more things than I am at this point in my career. So she speaks at a lot of meetings. She gets invited, and she's very honored, of course, when she does get invited. And it's fun for me to go. And I do register for the meetings, like the Women Ophthalmology meeting a few weeks ago in Marco Island. She was one of the speakers. I just went as the plus one, although I did, again, register for the meeting and listen to all the talks. And there were so many amazing talks at that meeting. Some great speakers, and it was just a fantastic meeting. So it's always fun listening to her and her friends and colleagues as well speaking.
Yeah, we're in a neat time now where there's just so much learning. But what's interesting is sometimes, you know, we go to these meetings mostly just to hang out and meet our friends. Because if you think about it, you can get a lot of the learning online now on your phone, right?
Very true. But it's not the same as being in a live meeting, not even close.
No, I agree with you 100%. Absolutely. What do you like doing outside of ophthalmology? You're obviously a busy guy with ophthalmology, but you must have some interest outside.
Well, I guess the new hobby is pickleball. Like, who doesn't want to play a little pickleball? So trying to pick that up a little bit. I mean, obviously being in South Florida, I grew up and I know how to play tennis and love ping pong. So it's kind of this nice little mix. Again, I'm not a veteran pickleball player yet, but just curious to see how it works. But I like sports like basketball and stuff like that as well when I do get an opportunity to play a little bit. And then obviously for a bigger hobby, it's like when I get a chance to go skiing. We have one ski meeting that I go to each year, the ACOS meeting, so I ski there. My daughter lives in Denver, so when I get to visit her, I get to do a little extra skiing, so that's always a really fun sport.
Yeah, people don't know, you are an amazing skier. You're like professional level, you're amazing.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I just love skiing. I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time when I was in college, and there's an opportunity to participate on the junior varsity ski team. So I learned how to be a racer in college because, again, it was kind of the junior varsity team. And, you know, you learn extra skills, and so it makes skiing fun to begin with. And so I just have a great time. And it's really this, just like you mentioned for the meetings, it's just a social experience. So you're all on the slopes with your friends, and that's why when there's a ski meeting where you have your colleagues, other ophthalmologists and optometrists that are there and you're all skiing together, it's a great experience.
Yeah, and a lot of learning happens like where you kind of least expect it. When you're off the podium, when you're in a hallway and someone pulls you aside and says, hey, let me ask you about this or the other.
Oh my God, it's nonstop, because I think we're always trying to improve our practice, figure out other ways of doing things better. And I think that I'm always trying to learn from my friends and colleagues, like, how do you handle this situation? What are you doing in your practice? How can you make the practice more efficient? How can you do a better job taking care of patients? I think one thing I love is that a lot of people are kind enough to share their preoperative forms and postoperative forms of explaining things to patients. That always helps. Like, you might have your own form that you've developed, but maybe, you know, Gary Wirtz has a great form. And so he came up with some great suggestions to put into a postoperative form to help explain things. And so learning, you know, we can all, you know, put that together and patients are better informed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, like one of the originators of this was Stephen Dell, who had his Dell questionnaire for presbyopic IOLs, gosh, more than a decade ago. And I think everyone in the country kind of just copied his framework. Even my questionnaire now was based on his original one from many years ago.
Absolutely. No, it was so nice to share with all of us. And I think it really made us better at talking to patients and understanding and making us understand that, you know, what, even though we have biases, we really need to find out from the patient what they're looking for. And I think, you know, I'm sure your questionnaire now is even more precise because you've been able to hone it over the years to figure out how to better make decisions for patients. Because they're looking to us to make decisions, but they have their own lives and they do different things and they're all different. You know, some people drive at night more, some people don't drive at night more, and you might use a different lens in each of those scenarios.
No, for sure. I think it's important for you as a surgeon to give the patient a specific recommendation. Take all their questionnaire into account, do your interview with the patient so you get to know them, look at all their biometry, their data, their macula, whatever, and then you give a specific recommendation. I think that's very important.
Absolutely. Yeah, I learned that. I know from you and also Eric Donofoe, the two people who said, you know, I remember, you know, at lectures as I was kind of earlier in my career, that, you know, just make the recommendation, and that really stuck with me, that I try to really work on that, to really work with my patients, make sure I don't give them choices of different intraocular lenses. I don't say, for example, we could do this presbyopic lens that gives you this or that other presbyopic lens which will give you that. I just figure out from them which presbyopic lens would be best for them.
Yeah, I think that's the best way of doing it because, you know, we're both physicians, we both do surgery, but what if you had to have a hip replacement tomorrow? I don't know a dang thing about the hip. And if the orthopedic surgeon gives me a list of, like, which of these five hip implants do you want, I don't really know. I have no way of figuring this out.
Yes, exactly. And there's no way in the time that's allotted that, you know, can really know, like, the patient can really make enough of a decision because they need to spend a lot of time trying to ask. It would be difficult for the patient, in other words, to try to figure out on their own. So that's where they need us to listen to them and make the recommendation. And sometimes we're wrong. I mean, we've all had patients where we thought a lens is going to be the perfect lens for them and they're not happy. And the good news is you can switch it out. You know, the companies will, which I found, which is great, they will reimburse the surgery center if we remove the lens. And then the patient can either go with a different type of presbyopic lens or go with a monofocal. But the patient, you know, it can work out for the patient. So the key is that there is, you know, options for the patient if they're not happy.
You know, that's for sure. I mean, we can't always bat 1,000, right?
We try, but we're not 100%. No, not a question.
Yeah, so what do you think's coming for us in cataract, refractive, corneal surgery? What's kind of coming down the road in the next, let's say, 5 or 10 years? What would you guess?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of things coming down the road. I think that, you know, the new things that are kind of interesting that we're just starting to work with now is there's a drop that Stephen Wilson developed called losartan. So losartan is an eye drop that actually can remove haze from the cornea. And so it was originally...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was originally used for patients that had PRK haze, and actually gets rid of that reticular haze very nicely. So it takes about 4 to 6 months of drops. You use it 6 times a day. Right now it's only made at compounding pharmacies, but it's worked very nicely for those patients. Both Jen, my wife, and I have had patients, and it's worked nicely for them for post-PRK haze that got referred to us. But then also there's now data for patients that have pretty significant scars where it could actually make it less severe over time. So this is going to be a new technology for our patients. So if you have a scar, maybe try topical losartan from a compounding drop. Again, Steve Wilson is the inventor of this, and he's done a lot of work on this. And again, we don't know everything about this drop, but it certainly seems to be promising for these challenging situations. So I think that's been a new thing for my practice, having that technology. The other new thing for my practice, just to share something new, is that, you know, I'm in Florida, so we see a lot of CINs. I'm not sure if you see OSSN or CINs in California, but, you know, for years we were using interferon, but now 5-FU has worked so great. So now we're just getting rid of patients. And I was a little hesitant to use 5-FU, but use it 4 times a day for a week and then a vacation for 3 weeks and do it again for another week, and then another vacation for 3 weeks. So it cycles. Usually 3 to 6 cycles are needed, and it just makes these CINs disappear. So those are some new things that have been in my practice recently that I get pretty excited about. As far as, like, what's next for us, I think it's always hard to know. I won't even guess which IOLs will be next. So I have to. I would say that, you know, when I'm thinking about what's next, I guess the big news will be on corneal transplants. So I think there's a couple different companies working on new ways of doing of helping patients that have Fuchs. There's, you know, there's obviously Trefoil that's developing an intraocular injection of medication inside the eye to help patients that have Fuchs and are undergoing cataract surgery to try to reduce the swelling that patients experience postoperatively, as well as help if you're going to do it's a procedure called DWEC. DWEC is where it's decimase removal without any placement of a donor tissue. And then the patient's own endothelial cells grow back across. And so you can use the Trefoil medication intraoperatively as well, and that'll help stimulate the endothelial cells to grow across. So we have that company. We have, I know that there's a company that's developing, by Dr. Kinoshita, that's developing an injection of endothelial cells inside the eye. You just basically... Again, I'm not sure if you have to remove the decimase or not, but then basically you inject the endothelial cells and it grows across, and that can also help. So there's a few new things coming out in corneal transplants, but they're not quite here yet. We still have a couple of years for those.
Yeah, those sound amazing. I mean, that make a big difference, because I'm always surprised at the number of patients who end up having Fuchs dystrophy. You see them with the slant preoperatively, and you're like, whoa, you've got Fuchs, and they've never been told.
Yes, yeah, because it can be subtle, and, you know, they're slowly seeing a little bit worse over time, and, you know, people might... Some doctors may not look closely enough at the endothelium and miss it. And if they're still seeing reasonably well, they can drive their car, you know, and there's nothing really to do anyway. You're not going to do any type of procedure on a patient with Fuchs unless they're having, you know, unless it's really affecting their vision.
So let's say you have a Fuchs patient with cataracts. These have cataract surgery. Do you have any guidelines or cutoffs like, oh, if the cell density is this much, just do the cataract alone, or if the corneal pachymetry is so much? Do you have any kind of guidelines?
Well, so I think you try to – I don't think there's a right answer to that, because people with low endothelial cell count or a certain corneal thickness can still end up with a good result with cataract surgery alone. So I think you have to evaluate the cornea and decide if you think the Fuchs is bad enough that even if you do cataract surgery, they're going to have very poor vision. So I try to – what I can – and what I learned, and I guess, you know, again, I'm not doing DSECs now or DMECs, but I was doing them for a while, and what I learned when I tried to do them together is that – sometimes, you know, the cataract surgery goes great, but the patient's DSEC or DMEC doesn't stay in place. And then it's, you have to rebubble it. It takes a little work. And the patients, I had a patient wondering, well, what would it have been like if I hadn't done that part? Would have just, would it, like, because she was a little frustrated with the struggle that occurred postoperatively. So now I guess I'm a little biased from that one patient, but I typically like to do the cataract surgery first, do everything in our power to reduce energy and protect the endothelium, and try to get patients through that and see how well they can do postoperatively. And if they're happy, then there's nothing more needs to be done. And I'd say that 98% or 99% of my patients with Fuchs don't need to have DSEC or DMEC within the first year of cataract surgery. So I'm not sure that's your experience. I mean, what's your experience?
No, I also like doing it staged, meaning let's just do the cataract now and let's see how you do. Let it heal up. You may be a little slower to heal in the post-op period. And then I think you're right. More than 90% of the time, that's enough. They're happy.
Yes, exactly. So that's what I found. And so I think patients appreciate that too. It's a simpler surgery. And then if they end up needing it, then again, it's a very straightforward surgery. You know, short, T-sec and DMEC are both very effective, safe, great results overall. And if needed, they can move to that. But maybe they don't need it for a couple years.
Right. Just, push it down the road to when you'll change your way you aim your patients then? Aim for just a tiny pinch of myopia post-op then instead of plano?
Well, you can do that. I think there's less of a hyperopic shift with DMEC than DSEC. And I think most doctors are doing DMEC. And then we don't know what's going to happen if Trefo's product or the endothelial cells get approved, then, you know, again, there may not be any type of shift. We don't know that. But so I'm targeting, you know, usually about a minus a quarter, minus a half for now.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I think that makes the most sense. Just probably that first minus.
Yes. But
I think, as we get these thinner and thinner DMET graphs, I think you don't have to have that much of a shift. Sometimes it's very minimal shift.
Correct, yes. That's what we found. So that's been my strategy for those patients.
Anything new coming for laser vision correction?
Well, I think there's always new things. I mean, obviously, what's interesting, I think, for patients with interest in refractive surgery, I think that, again, the ICL has really been increasing in popularity. It's a really nice technology because it's an easy surgery, 4 to 5 minute surgery as far as doing the implantation and getting and sometimes the flushing out of the viscoelastic can take a couple extra minutes, but it's a very easy, safe procedure with great results. And then you have LASIK, SMILE, and PRK, and I think we keep seeing incremental improvements. The main new thing coming out that I'm aware of is that J&J has a new laser that right now is making flaps, but will soon do a procedure similar to SMILE. I believe it's working. They're doing it internationally. It's not yet available in the U.S. So that's going to be interesting. There'll be two technologies in the U.S. for SMILE surgeries or SMILE-like surgeries. So I think there's definitely interesting technologies that are coming, but I think currently our patients undergoing LASIK, SMILE, and PRK are doing quite well. And now that we have great drops for preoperatively, pre-op drops for if you're doing PRK, we have great ways to reduce pain and discomfort and speed healing. So PRK is actually my favorite of those three options, but LASIK and SMILE are great as well. So at the end of the day, I think we have lots of options for our patients.
Yeah, in fact, I had Marguerite McDonald on the podcast, and she switched to 100% PRK and doesn't do any LASIK anymore. And she shared with us, we posted on Cataract Coach already, she shared her protocol for her regimen of drops and medication for PRK. I just did it for the first time yesterday, copied her exactly.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, no, she's got a great regimen. She uses oral steroids, and she, I know her technique. So we were both back in 2003, we both stopped LASIK from about 2002, 2003, and did mostly PRK for a number of years, and then went back to LASIK when the Femto came about. But again, it's been a little while since I've done LASIK, because again, I've been a big fan of PRK and then doing lots of ICLs as well.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I think outside the U.S. too, there are a lot more options. You have, for corneal lenticular extraction, you have multiple different laser platforms. I see it on Facebook, you know, friends post the videos of them doing the surgery. I'm like, wow, I didn't know that company, you know, the lasers aren't even available in the U.S.
Yes, I mean, again, I think that that's a great technology. You know, again, lenticular extraction, really, you know, you're avoiding some of the risks with LASIK, and so it seems very positive. So I think that, again, is a growing area, and we'll see more and more work in that area.
For us, you know, people who are still doing LASIK, a good amount of it, what do you recommend to help minimize that ectasia risk? So obviously, flaps with a femtosecond laser are far more predictable, so we do that exclusively. But do you recommend a little thinner flap? Do you recommend smaller diameter? Or is there anything that's been shown to make a difference or not really?
Well, I think a few things for reducing risk for ectasia. One is good preoperative evaluation, so trying to really be very suspicious, and if not, you know, switch to ICL or PRK. Number two is talk to the patients about eye rubbing. So I do see patients coming back with post-LASIK ectasia, and they do share, oh yeah, you know, I've had these allergies. And again, this is 10 or 15 years after their surgery. And they say, oh yeah, my right eye's been bothering me, so I've been itching a lot. And they do share that they've been doing a lot of eye rubbing. So so that I would definitely talk to patients about never rub your eyes, or, you know, if you can, remind them that. I think, you know, a thinner flaps, of course, makes sense, but obviously you don't want to make it too thin. So you want to have a nice flap that's easy to work with, but not super, you know, too thin where you could have an issue. Because again, the good thing is that if someone were to develop post-LASIK ectasia, then there is a great treatment, cross-linking. So I think the other thing I could mention is that remind their patients they should be being seen once every year, every other year, and get a map of their cornea. So I do, every patient that has a history of LASIK, when they come to see me, whether it's my patient or they had it somewhere else, I always get a pentacam, and I've been surprised. I've identified ectasia a handful of times when people thought they were doing pretty well. And so we're able to say, oh, listen, we have this concern. Maybe they don't need crossing that visit, but we'll see them back and make sure it's stable, you know, see if it's stable, what's going on. And so just something to throw out that I try to image every patient that has a history of LASIK when they come to see me for a regular exam.
Right, because they could be developing a little bit early ectasia, but yet the central cornea still looks great, and they still see beautifully, and they don't really have a complaint. But that way you are kind of alerted and you can watch it a little bit closer.
Absolutely. You know, what's really interesting is I put together a series of patients that have just regular keratoconus, no ectasia, that have obvious keratoconus. Like, you and I, everyone could identify this patient as keratoconus, yet they have uncorrected 20/20 vision. And now I have almost 10 patients that have it in at least one eye where they have 20/20 vision. So it's no surprise that these patients are out there driving their cars, doing everything. They don't know anything's wrong, and they're able to do everything. Then they come in and they, you know, they have pretty significant keratoconus because they didn't need to see the eye doctor. They didn't need to get glasses ever, so no one ever picked up that they had keratoconus.
Right. Wow, yeah. That's so interesting.
Right. And so the same thing would be with ectasia patients. You know, they had LASIK, they think they're doing well. They don't realize that they're slowly getting a little bit worse, and they may be developing it. And unless you do the scan, you're not going to know that they actually have early ectasia.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. And especially if you've got your topography steps set appropriately, then you'll catch it.
There you go. Exactly, exactly. Beautiful.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's such an interesting thing for us. I mean, I'm just so passionate about, like you, like with cataract surgery and refractive surgery, and gosh, I just wonder where it's going to take us. I'm kind of sad that we don't have a bigger uptake of it in the U.S. I think it's just, with the increasing incidence of myopia, which is just crazy now, if you look at some cities like Singapore and Hong Kong, where it's like 80% of young people are myopic, I think the U.S. is kind of headed that way too, especially when you see all these little kids all day sitting on a cell phone.
Yeah, it's really crazy. You know, thankfully in South Florida, we have a lot of optometrists that are really focused in myopia control. So I am seeing a lot of patients coming in on medication. They're on either doing the atropine, low-dose atropine drops, or doing the Ortho-K or special contact lenses. There's three different pathways for these patients, but it definitely seems to be helpful. And the key is, if you see a patient that's myopic, who's, you know, 12, 14, 16, even 18, and they're myopic, they can actually benefit. Even an 18-year-old could benefit from myopia control, because patients with myopia will continue to advance into their early 20s.
Right. So that begs the question, what's your sweet spot for, or your earliest age you'd prefer to do PRK or LASIK for someone? Do you make them wait till 22, 24, 25?
I do not. So first of all, my son, who's now about to turn 21, when he turned 18, he's about -3. I did PRK in him when he was 18, but it made sense. Look, he was a contact lens wearer, but played lots of sports. He's actually into crazy adventurous things, like, you know, he surfs, he skis, he's actually into skydiving, so like making him, well, he wasn't skydiving back then, but I just knew he had that personality, so I wanted to get him out of contacts and be able to, you know, do all the things he wants to do and not have to worry about contacts. So he did PRK on him and he did beautifully. So I think 18 is the cutoff I've always used. Again, there's a chance someone could progress in their mid-20s and need a little enhancement or touch-up, but it's been pretty rare when we look at our patients. Most patients do really well for a long period of time.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Plus, if you can always go back and do a little bit more PRK.
Right. And I think the other thing to understand, if you have an 18-year-old, you don't target Plano. You target plus 0.6, plus 0.7. Yeah. And that gives them an extra room. So, you know, if they were to advance by a doctor over 10 years, then, you know, they're still going to be just a little bit myopic. Again, these are 18 to 30-year-olds. I target hyperopia.
No, that's for sure. I mean, you certainly got to take age into account in choosing that refractive target, right? If you got someone who's minus 3 and they're 42 years old, you better not overcorrect them.
Exactly. Yeah, those patients, I'm usually doing a 42-year-old, I'm usually making one eye about a minus 0.5 and the other eye Plano, and, you know, hoping that that works for them. You know, we usually do that in a trial.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, that's awesome. Yeah, the last thing I think is coming, at least I hope is coming, is accommodating lenses, accommodating IOLs. And hopefully there'll be many horses in the race, and if maybe one or two or even many of them actually, you know, hit the finish line of that race.
That would be absolutely amazing. I'm still young, so I know I have a ways to go till I'm going to need cataract surgery. But when I do, I'm hoping that there will be an accommodating lens available. I mean, I think we have great options now. I wouldn't be afraid to use a couple of the different technologies we have now. But I'm hoping for further advancements by the time I'm ready for surgery.
What do you think is available now for presbyopes? So let's say, you know, your average, say, 50-ish-year-old person. What are the good options now? You see presbyope who's 50.
So plano presbyope, I don't like to treat because I think it's very difficult to nail 20/20 plus get reading for a patient because it's still variability. You might end up 20/25 or 20/30. Let's say you pick a PanOptics, Symphony OptiBlue, Synergy, or Vivity, and it's hard to get 20/20 in both eyes in each of those patients. So what I've learned that they may end up 20/30 for distance. Yes, they get reading, but they're not as happy. They're like, wait, I can't see as well for distance. So I've been avoiding the plano presbyopes for 50-year-olds for refractive surgery, RLE. I think we can get there with a light adjustable lens if someone really wants to get there. So with a light adjustable lens, we could nail that 20/20 for distance and make the other eye do a blended vision. But with a multifocal lens, I'm avoiding the plano patients. But if they're plus 1 or plus 1.5, then I've been really happy with all the lens technologies. But my go-to right now is the Symphony OptiBlue. That's one that's been working the best in my practice. But again, in my own practice, I have some doctors that like PanOptics, some like Vivity. So there's no consensus. All the lenses are great. We're very lucky to have great technologies for our patients. And then plus having light adjustable lens for patients that have, in my practice, I'm using it for patients with previous LASIK, previous RK, patients that have some degree of irregularity, or patients that want to do monovision so I can really make sure I nail monovision.
Well, you must have in Florida a lot of RK patients, right?
So thankfully not. We're not like Arizona. So for RK patients, I see maybe one for surgery a month or every 2 months. It's thankfully. And then some of them are some are coming from South America. You know, they're not that much. There was not a lot of RK surgeons here in South Florida. There was a few, and they were very low volume. So thankfully, there's not a lot. I think Florida, Miami was relatively conservative. My dad and his partner, they did a handful of cases. I met some of my dad's patients that he did RK on 30 plus years ago. And, you know, so thankfully there was, but they were very low volume.
Wow. Yeah. Here in LA, I do 2, 3, 4 RK patients a week.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Cataract surgery. Yeah.
Yes.
I just had one this week where she had 16 RK cuts and 2 lasso sutures.
Oh my gosh. That's not easy to cut. Those are challenging cases. So, can you want to share how did you pick the IOL?
Yeah, the videos, by the time our podcast is up, the video will already be on Cataract Coach. But yeah, obviously the tough part is calculating the lens power. And then for this one, I actually chose the small aperture IOL.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, well, the reason is this eye had a really irregular cornea. And beautiful. So I took into account the recommendations of aiming for a little bit of myopia post-op, minus a half, minus 75, get the benefit of that pinhole. And then luckily for this person, the very central cornea was pretty clean and didn't have any irregularity. And so I think the pinhole really made a big difference. I only saw the patient on post-op day 1 so far, As you know, these patients, the cornea incisions swell. So initially, right after surgery, they're a little on the hyper side. And obviously, to do the surgery, I made a scleral tunnel. I didn't touch the cornea at all.
Right. That's key. For 16 cuts, it can be hard to find a spot. But sometimes you will, not 16, but 8, you can find a spot in the cornea sometimes. But 16, then you got to pull back. I agree.
Yeah. So, yeah, we get some tough ones here. I've had a handful of 32 cut RK patients.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is a little excessive.
And I just wonder how they're, like, so the real question is, okay, if you make them minus a half or minus one today, where will they be in 5 and 10 years? Because they probably will still keep shifting.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Right. The RK is a gift that keeps on giving. So it keeps kind of pushing that patient towards plano and then to hyper.
Yes.
But if you can give the patient, you know, a good solid 10 years without much shift, I think the patient's going to be pretty happy.
Oh, no question. Yeah. Thankfully, short term, they're going to do fantastic. So, and then you could always do it if they come back and see you 10, 15 years later, you could always do a piggyback lens at that point.
Yeah, if you need to. Absolutely. That makes a whole lot of sense there. Yeah, though, all kinds of fun patients. Yeah, that's why I get going back to the beginning of our conversation, how it's so much fun to learn from these little cases, case studies.
No question. Yeah, because again, we learn different strategies for each of these patients. And again, there's so many different ways to handle them. So, you know, again, small aperture lens would have, if you had asked me a quiz, I would have probably gone more to the light adjustable lens as a first choice. But small aperture lens makes so much sense as well. And again, you get me thinking, okay, next time I see that type of patient, I may go that direction. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, especially in this patient, because there was corneal irregularity. Now, her opposite eye, we're not going to put the small aperture lens in. So her opposite eye had a lot more regular cornea.
Nice,
especially
okay.
Centrally. So, yes, I think the patient will do great.
But I'm sure they will.
Time will tell. Time will tell. Yes. Five cases.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Where can we learn from you next? Where can we see you next? Which meeting? Because I always like to sit in your audience.
Oh, gosh. We go to too many meetings. So, I guess we're going to Bar Harbor for the Down East Ophthalmology meeting in a couple weeks. It's a beautiful meeting in Maine. And then we'll be at OSN New York. Then, of course, I do go to AAO, but more there, I'm more networking there. And then Hawaiian Eye, ACOS Aspen, and then probably, I guess, Askaris after that.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing you soon at some of these meetings, and I'm sure we'll keep learning from each other and having a great time doing it.
No questions. Always great. Uday, you teach. You're such an incredible teacher, so I love listening to your lectures. You always have great cases, really interesting cases, and I always learn each time I see you present.
Thank you. And don't forget, now you got to send us some kind of video. In any case you want.
Yes.
We'll feature it on Cataract Coach.
Okay, perfect. All right, Bill. Happy to.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Uday. Thank you so much.
Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me. I trust that you learned a lot. Please leave me a suggestion below and let me know who you'd like as a future guest. And also, please subscribe to our videos and our podcasts. And tell your friends about it. Remember, these podcasts are also available in audio format only for Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, and more. If you want to watch the video, they're on YouTube and on cataractcoach.com.